Yeah, getting kind of paranoid.
Yeah.
Tell Clem you're going to move it from the head of Clem.
I already heard.
But you're welcome to. Yeah, that's fine.
I think we're mostly here. Let's call to order the House Committee on Land Use for Thursday, February 12th, 2009, Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday. And we will open a work session on House Bill 2375. Can you briefly remind us what the bill is?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The measure discontinues within 1 year of taking effect an exception created in 2003, allowing a long-standing fireworks business to use lands zoned exclusively for farm use.
Okay, thanks. So we are in work session, colleagues. We held a hearing, you'll recall, a week ago. Heard a bit of testimony from people supporting the bill and from some people who opposed the bill or wanted some changes to the bill. And as a result of that testimony, there's an amendment that is ready to be moved. Representative Garrett.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to dated February 11, 2009, to House Bill 2375.
Okay. Representative Garrett moves the Dash 3 amendments. I think everyone has that amendment on their desk, and I believe, I'm looking around, I handed that amendment to people earlier today so that you would have a chance to look at it. So we are open for discussion on that amendment, and I know I have at least one person in the audience. Although we're under work session and we do not have to take public testimony, I've told Mr. DiLorenzo on behalf of his client he could have 3 minutes to address the committee. Mr. DiLorenzo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner of the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Western Fireworks Display, Inc. They testified last week here in opposition to the bill. At the conclusion of the testimony, Mr. Chamoff was asked to make several suggestions. He did so. There are two amendments potentially in play. One is the Dash 3, which is currently before you. Another is the Dash 4. The Dash 4 would basically render Western a non-conforming use pursuant to RS 215-130, which is a statute that generally pertains to non-conforming uses. What that statute provides is that a non-conforming use can stay there. It cannot expand its footprint. However, if there is a fire loss, it can rebuild. If there are changes necessitated because of health or safety regulations, it can also comply with those. It is the way in our code that non-conforming uses are generally treated. The bill that you have before you, in my view, goes way beyond what maybe the intent is, which is to only apply to the current owner's use of the building. And in particular, if you take a look at line 12, a change of ownership of any kind would result in forfeiture of the business. That would mean that if one of Mr. Gobe's family members who owned stock was killed in a tragic accident and the stock ownership changed in any respect, in addition to that tragedy, he would face closure of his business. Line 15, any new or additional mortgage would cause a forfeiture of the business. That would mean if he refinanced, there would be a new mortgage to take the place of the old mortgage. That would cause a forfeiture of his business. If a dishonest contractor filed a lien on his property and was wrong, that would cause a forfeiture of his business. And in line 17, a permit that expired would cause a forfeiture of his business. Well, most permits expire and then are renewed. So if a permit expired, notwithstanding his efforts to renew, that would cause a forfeiture of his business. So if the intention of the Dash 3 is to limit the current owner's use of the building, and only to that current owner. I would just submit that, unfortunately, the Dash 3 as written goes way beyond those parameters. I do think one way to effectuate the intent of what I heard in the testimony would be to adopt the Dash 4s. Madam Chair, I truly appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. I know this is extraordinary to do that, and I thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
Thanks, Mr. DiLorenzo. Questions? Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. DiLorenzo, looking at the Dash 3 amendment, you mentioned a simple stock change among family members. Do you read this to say that a stock change among family members would render the property unable to be used as its current use?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, the language is a change of ownership of any kind, including several things, but not necessarily limited to those things, because it says of any kind including. And my worry is that if a owner of a significant number of shares or of a significant interest changed over, that could very easily be viewed as a change of ownership of any kind.
Follow-up?
Quick follow-up, yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If this landowner had an opportunity to refinance the property at more favorable financial rates, do you read this to also encumber him in the way that the use would not be allowed?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I do, and that is because one of the forfeiture provisions is, quote, a new or additional mortgage, lien, or other encumbrance is secured by the building, structure, or land. Whenever one refinances, there's a payoff, the trust deed or the mortgage is satisfied, and a new mortgage is substituted. Therefore, that would be a condition of forfeiture.
Madam Chair, one final follow-up. Mr. DiLorenzo, as you would value a business and place on the balance sheet value for the location of a business, do you see this landowner potentially having recourse if this amendment were to pass, given that his valuation would be lessened by the deduction here?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I would view this as converting what was essentially a fee simple ownership and an ongoing concern to basically a life estate, which would reduce the value to almost zero other than the basic farmland value. So I would see a significant potential for a takings claim here.
Thanks, Representative Greenlick.
Yes, thank you. Could you refresh my memory, was this particular property granted the right to be in an inappropriate location by action of the 2003 session of the legislature?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlick, the short answer is yes. The property, the business was ongoing prior to the adoption of Senate Bill 100. Had it not moved from one location to another, it would have been grandfathered under Senate Bill 100. It moved to an EFU zone at the request of fire authorities who wanted to be able to control a blaze if one occurred, given all of the explosive materials that were conveyed or that were contained on the site. When it became apparent to Clackamas County officials that it was in the wrong zone, Clackamas County urged us to come to the legislature to fix that problem. We did so in 2003. Senator Schrader at the time introduced the amendment. It was very restricted due primarily to our negotiations with Farm Bureau and with Thousand Friends that did not want to open the arena to everyone but recognized the value in preserving the jobs that were there. Our other problem was we couldn't locate in an industrial zone. I mean, theoretically we could, or a commercial zone, but no one wanted to be around us, that we would need hundreds of acres without, you know, away from the nearest building.
May I follow up?
For safety.
But I might want to suggest that we not ascribe intention to parties who are not at the witness table, please.
Well, I know that Farm Bureau representatives are here, and if you'd like to call them up.
We heard from them last week, and they supported the bill as written. Thanks.
Yeah, I was trying to clarify the question, though. That the move was illegal, and it was an action of the legislature that made it legal. So now you're suggesting that another action of the legislature correcting that situation would be a taking?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlake, I'm not suggesting that there is a correction here. I am suggesting that once a right has been given, if the right is taken away and it is a vested right, it is likely tantamount to a taking.
And just one more brief question.
Sure, Representative.
Is there anything in this amendment that would stop the owners from moving the structure to a legal place?
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlake, there is nothing in this amendment that would prevent relocation in an industrial zone. The only problem with doing that is that hundreds of acres of industrial land would be needed, which is not a very good use of industrial land. But no, the answer to your question is nothing would prevent them at any time from moving other than the economics, which means they would lose their employees because they wouldn't be able to maintain a going concern.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did I see your hand, Representative Esquivel, and then Representative Winger?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. DiLorenzo, reading this, I could go down and file a lien on this property, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, you could wrongfully file a lien on this property.
That's correct. The other thing is, if, let's say, a public sewage system came in, a county sewer system, I do know that once that is plotted out, that it automatically goes on a lien on your property at that point until such time you pay it once they complete the frontage on your property. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, that is correct, and that would also be a condition of forfeiture, which is why I cannot imagine that that would be the intention by the proponents of the amendment, but that's what would, in fact, happen.
Thank you.
You're getting close again, Mr. DiLorenzo. Representative Winger.
Thank you. Mr. DiLorenzo, could you remind me, please, how many people are employed at this business?
Madam Chair, Representative Wingard, there are 10 full-time employees who receive family wage jobs, or family wage wages, and then there are up to 1,000 part-time employees for any period of time from 10 days to a month during the fireworks display season who also receive excellent wages and who would all be out of the job.
Thank you, sir.
Anybody else? Thanks.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I appreciate your courtesies.
Thank you. Questions on the floor to move the dash three amendments into the bill. Discussion among committee members on the amendment. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we heard some logical questions about a piece of property that's an ongoing business, and I find it unfathomable that given the number of ways these folks can lose the use of their business, be it a new sewer system or water system going by in front of their property, an unscrupulous contractor filing a lien, the inability to go out and seek refinancing when they could better themselves from a financial standpoint, and I guess on and on, but it seems hardly fathomable that this body, let alone this committee, intends to put that type of legislation on the back of an ongoing business and landowner. I guess if this is your amendment, I'd like to understand the reasons why.
Okay. Thanks. Representative Klein.
So I'm going to support the dash three amendments. They replace the line 5-8, which gave 1 year essentially to deal with this. And I think this is a preferable approach, that we're replacing the 1 year with some structure around what happens. And if I can just back away for a second, we wouldn't be having this conversation if a single property was not exempted into the farm zone. And I wasn't here then. I don't know what deals were struck, but this is the same issue we heard in our big look, which is when land use was set up, the restraining of the urban growth boundary and the setting up of the exclusive farm use is to try and keep incompatible uses, whether it's neighbors complaining about pesticides, whether it's commercial and farming activities that are that don't always blend. Farm stands are commercial, farms aren't. This is what happens when an exception is made for one person and one company, even though it's clearly a good company who's doing good work, but someone made a horrible mistake in letting this in my opinion, to the EFU zone in the beginning. They did it at the request of, apparently, of fire safety. So you can't blame them for doing it, but this is the mess now we have to go through to try and sort out why special exemptions were made. So now you get a special solution, which is how to deal with this one company. And it's, you know, I think at some point we're going to get a chance to look holistically about it, but this was the making of the 2003 legislature, and we're going to have to figure out how to get out of it. A dash 3 is preferable to what's in the 2375, in my opinion, so I'm going to support it.
Any other discussion? Representative Greenlick.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. I was here in 2003, and I was on the Land Use Committee, and if my memory is correct, there were other similar businesses that came in at that time and argued that if this exemption was to be given to this company, that the other companies ought to have an exemption for doing the same thing in EFU. That was rejected in favor of a single solution for this company. I think the legislature made a mistake in that time period. I think this is a correction of the mistake. I supported 2375 in its original form, and I think the dash 3 amendments soften it to make it much more reasonable. And I support both the dash 3 amendments and the bill as amended.
Okay. Thanks, Representative. Representative Escobar?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. This, I'm curious on where, who, what, when, where, why, and how this even came up. The other thing that I would like to throw out to this committee is, other than you have to have 100 and some acres of industrial land that you eat up, where are you going to put this thing? The third thing I pose on this issue, has there been a problem? I cannot support this. You're putting someone, you're going to eventually put someone out of business, and here you're talking about cuts, cuts, cuts in this budget. So now you're going to go after 10 people or more in the long run. I think that is, these amendments are egregious. I will never condone what they were doing here. And when a government entity causes the problem in the first place, then we should be addressing that, not necessarily the individual that tried to comply. And that's what we're doing.
Representative Wingert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is emblematic of conducting business in this state. And I have talked for a long time about the business climate in this state, and I think this is just another example. I cannot imagine why we would take a business which is apparently operating legally and providing 10 full-time employees with wages and a service to Oregonians, in this case it's fireworks they do, but they provide a service, and this legislature is going to destroy them. But unfortunately, that's quite common in this state. I am very disappointed that as a freshman legislator that this will be one of the early things that I watch this legislature do, and I think this is shameful. I will be a no vote.
I'll remind the committee that, Representative Hanna?
Madam Chair, was it your intention to answer the question about your reasoning?
I'm going to speak at the end of the discussion, yes.
Okay, thank you.
So, anybody else? First of all, I want to remind the committee that the question before us is the amendment. Is the amendment better than the underlying bill? Does the amendment improve the bill? And then there will be a second vote on the bill as amended if the amendment is approved. The bill came to us through an interim committee on consumer safety, I think. But it came to us through an interim committee that had been concerned with issues around safety. And it is part of additional work that we will do in this committee around exclusive farmland zoning. So this is the first of what will probably be a few other bills on exclusive farm use, which is the jurisdiction of this committee. After listening to the testimony, all of the testimony that we heard last week, and I'll also refresh our memories, that Mr. Chamoff and his clients were only some of the people who came to testify. We heard from firefighters, we heard from Thousand Friends, we heard from, I think, the Farm Bureau, we heard from other people who saw to the original underlying piece of protecting farmland, which from my point of view is also a productive economic use of land in the state and produces jobs as well. The current use of the land is not the only economically productive use that that land could be put to, and I'd submit to you it's not the only use of that land that could employ Oregonians in that site, and perhaps even as many or more Oregonians on the same land as are currently being employed. So I don't think that this bill, whether it passes or not, spells an automatic end and non-recoverable for the jobs that are currently supported on this land. A couple quick details. I don't think we should take Mr. DiLorenzo's assertions as the only point of view on the language on the page, let alone the intent behind it, particularly with respect to mortgages and liens and other encumbrances. The language clearly says secured by the building, structure, or land. Some unscrupulous person who tries to impose a lien doesn't fit the language that's clearly on the page. However, if the property owner goes out and wants to expand or do something else and secures a lien, that would be covered because that's a change from the way they're currently operating. And it is my intent and my hope that while we will acknowledge and through this amendment create a non-conforming use and allow the current operator to continue operating on the land under that use. But with respect to permits that may or may not expire, the current property owner, the current business owner, has already assumed that business risk. When a permit is issued by a state agency or a local agency, the business owner has no guarantee that that permit will be extended when it expires. So that business risk has already been assumed by the business owner. This amendment and this bill adds no additional business risk to that equation. And in fact, there are two sections of this amendment that I think substantially improve from the current bill the rights to continue operating for the current owner of the one property in the state that's affected. Those are the section that delete lines 5 through 8, the original bill, purported to require the existing operation to cease and desist 12 months after the effective date of the bill. This amendment removes that obligation. And Mr. DiLorenzo correctly points out that that effectively turns the current use into a non-conforming use. Lines 6 to 8 of the amendment give the current property owner rights that they would not have, do not have now, and would not have if all we did was remove cease and desist section from the other bill. Most specifically, giving the current property owner the right to make alterations to the property to comply with new and unforeseen and frankly unforeseeable impositions of public safety requirements. I didn't think it would be fair to say you can make, back up, a non-conforming use under current law. This is another one where I disagree with the interpretation Mr. DiLorenzo presented. Under current law, a non-conforming use does not have the right to alter, expand, or change the use, even to comply with new regulations. Lines 6 through 8 actually would give that property owner rights that they would not that no other non-conforming use has in the state. And I guess I'd sum up with saying I have a problem with the notion that this amendment and the bill with the amendment in it would make it impossible for someone to conduct this business in the state. The current owner of this property holds a license issued by the state fire marshal to store and manufacture fireworks on site. There are 15 other businesses currently operating in the state of Oregon under permit from the state fire marshal for similar or the same purposes. And they have 3 permit requests pending. I'd be inclined to interpret that to mean that at least 14 other businesses find a way to succeed without having the benefit of this exemption in exclusive farm use. So I would take that, I would conclude from that it is possible to manage and successfully run these kinds of businesses in this state without this kind of exclusive exemption. So those are the reasons that I brought this amendment forward. I think they strike a balance between getting rid of and truly closing an existing business and protecting farmland for farm use. And that's why, after listening to all the testimony, I asked LC to draft this amendment as it is. So we have a motion on the floor, and I think we should take a vote on that motion. The motion is to move the Dash 3 amendment. So, call the roll.
Representative Clinton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Cleveland?
Aye.
Representative Hanna?
No.
Representative Williams?
No.
Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
No.
Chair Nolan?
Aye. Motion carries. So now we have the bill as amended in front of us. Representative Esquivel, did you?
Well, I'd like to adopt the Dash 4 amendments, but probably to no avail, but I will move that we adopt the Dash 4 amendments as everyone has and has been outlined by Mr. DiLorenzo. But I don't know how you're going to do that with the Dash 3 has been adopted.
So is that a motion or?
I'll make the motion to adopt the Dash 4.
Representative Esquivel moves the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2375. Discussion on the motion?
Thank you.
Representative Hanna?
Yeah. Having just seen the Dash 4 amendment presented 10, 15, 20 minutes ago. It's interesting to me that what we have an opportunity to do, had we given this amendment a run ahead of time, is to allow the operator of the business the ability to operate the business under the non-conforming standards as provided in ORS 215130, and likely we should have added the ability to alter, accept, to comply with lawful requirement for alteration to use and satisfy public health and safety. We probably should have done that.
because that does make sense to add to a business. In contrary to some of the discussions we've heard, a contractor could lien the property had they performed work on the property. The Dash 4 amendment would not allow for that. And contrary to what the Dash 3 is, the Dash 4 amendment does not put handcuffs on the owner of a business or property who may want to better their business or property through the use of preferred financing or better financing. I shouldn't be speechless, but I almost am, folks. This is just incredible that we are going to do to a business what we're about to do. We have an opportunity through another amendment to just say, use the nonconforming use, take care of your business, and be there. When you compare the two and you say, well, if you die or one of your owners dies, sorry, you're out of business. If you get a lien on your property, sorry, you're out of business. The Dash 4 simply allows this business to operate in a manner that most other businesses in the state of Oregon have the opportunity to do. It would be the right thing to do.
Other comments? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The thing that troubles me here the most is, like all of us in business and or in our homes, if you wanted to refi to get some cash out to help your business and your home, or do some upgrading, you could do so. This individual with the Dash 3 can't do that. The other thing is, no matter, in spite of what you've heard here today, you can file a lien on someone, on their property. Doesn't mean it's right, but you can do so. The other thing, you can actually quit claim this thing and record it and really cloud the title. There's all kinds of ways that you can make this life miserable for this individual. And we've just opened up the gates to do so. I'm just astounded that we're even at this crossroads. We talk the talk, but we don't walk the walk when it comes to keeping businesses in business and helping business in the state. It's an unfortunate day in this capital if these Dash 3 amendments go through as they are now.
Any other discussion on the Dash 4 amendment? Representative Clem.
Point of clarification, I mean, because of the way it's worded, they literally would make no sense at this point.
They are in conflict.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Call the roll on the Dash 4s.
Representative Clem?
No.
Representative Cowan?
No.
Representative Greenland?
No.
Representative Hammond?
Yes.
Representative Wingard?
Yes.
Vice Chair Garrett?
No.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Yes.
Chair Nolan?
No. Motion fails. On the main bill as amended.
Madam Chair, I move HB 2375 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrett moves House Bill 2375 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Yes, Representative.
Thank you. I really do think we need to put the historical context in here. Our terrible treatment of business. This business established illegally in 1986 an operation in an exclusive farm zone use that was completely inappropriate, and it operated for 17 years in an exclusive farm zone use when it had no business operating in an exclusive farm zone use. In 2003, the owners came to us not to make these kind of businesses an exemption in exclusive farm zone use, which could have been,
But to give it exclusive rights to have a fully appropriate use in a farm zone, in an exclusive farm zone. We granted that in Senate Bill 667 in 2003. The reflection, now here's a business that operated for 17 years inappropriately. The legislature, being kind to business, being kind to a specific business, not to other fireworks things which need 1,000 acres or whatever it is we've heard today, but only for this one business that had been operating inappropriately for 17 years, we made an exemption. Our committees, looking at safety and a variety of other things, have decided that was an inappropriate thing to have done. And now, 6 years later, we're redoing what we had done in 2003. And I won't get into the politics of what happened in 2003, but I was actively involved in it, so I remember very vividly. It seems to me this allows this business to continue. It makes clear this is not an acceptable use for EFU. Well, if we didn't get an amendment to let its competitors do this, we only have an amendment to let this do it. If we're so kind to business, why wasn't your amendment to allow the competitors of this business to have the same economic advantage that we granted as a legislature in 2003? I think redressing that makes sense, and I think this is an appropriate way to do it, and I support this bill.
Great. Thanks. Okay. Representative Klim, and I'm happy to have a discussion. We do have a panel of other people we've invited for the next bill, but
okay.
I want to make sure the committee has time to make its points.
Just briefly, I do think that the bill as amended is superior to the existing bill in terms of the 1 year, and that's it. There's some enhancements one way, there's some enhancements the other way. Again, the fundamental issue for me personally and how I view this bill, having not been here in 03, is I own EFU land or co-own it in a couple different parts of Oregon, and I've not tried to sell it to somebody who then wanted to use it for something that was non-conforming. I've not tried to do those things. I live under the rules and the existing rules. And if I did make a change in my property that was a true non-conforming use, these would be, well, A, I'd be out of compliance with all kinds of laws, and there'd be a lot of enforcement on me. B, I would be in a situation where if it burned down, I'm out of luck. You know, that's the risk I took for going about it that way and living with that zone. And it's important to remember the history. Thank you, Representative Greenlick. But more importantly is at some point saying that, as the Oregon Farm Bureau said, that's why they support the bill, farmland is not a place to go buy cheap ground for other activities. It is exclusive farm use. That's what the word is. That's what it means. This particular provision and other provisions, if you talk to farmers at that banquet last night, drives them crazy. And I'm pleased to be able to fix it. Is everything in here perfect in terms of, can we all agree on the interpretation? Apparently not. But when I read new or additional mortgage, I read new additional mortgage, not refinance mortgage. So that's just part of this process, I guess, is establishing the legislative record and people's opinion. And, you know, there's a whole other chamber on some of these minor questions. But I'm strongly in support of the effort to deal with this past problem and in the future try and find how to make the EFU zone more effective for farming.
Okay. All right. Call the roll on the motion.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes,
I'm pleased that a member of this committee has talked so much about this business operation for the past 17 or 18 years. Comparisons have been made to say we might lose 10 jobs. That's a snapshot. here's a company that's been operating for this many years, employing that many people, more or less, for all of that time period. That's a rolling calendar of employment. That's a history of employment. I'm also pleased that this committee has brought up the safety issue, because yes, we did hear a lot of testimony. We heard from fire folks, we heard from a number, and not one of those people, to my recollection, said this facility has a record of not being safe. In fact, what we heard is they have a perfect safety record. That should stand for something. This is a business, and we've heard it described as inappropriate. I don't believe it was ever illegal. These folks were asked to move for a reason. They did so. They had all the permits. They had all the licenses. They were doing business in a fair and appropriate manner. They were employing people over all this time period. I again, find this to be egregious and will not be supportive of this type of action by this body.
Okay. Representative Wingert.
I was just wondering if we would like to raise his taxes before we put him out of business.
Do you have an amendment to that effect?
Well, does it have the votes? I mean, let's extract some money out of him before we put him out of business. I mean, I withdraw my proposed amendment.
Thank you. Before we actually take the vote, Ms. Ross, would you put on the record the fiscal impact statement?
There is no fiscal impact, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We did run this amendment through Ledge Fiscal, and the bill, as amended with the Dash 3 amendment, has no fiscal, so it can go directly to the floor. Call the roll on the motion to move it to the floor.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Anna.
No.
Representative Wingert.
No.
Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Escobar.
No.
Chair Nolan.
Yes. Motion carries. Representative Clem, would you carry this bill on the floor, please?
Sure.
Thanks. Close work session on House Bill 2375, and let's open a work session on House Bill 2229. Colleagues, we have some, although we're under work session, we did invite panelists to speak with us about House Bill 2229. Some of them have been invited by members of the committee to join us. So I would like to ask John Charles to testify, please. And Dave Honeycutt. Is Dave here? See, Mr. Honeycutt. Oh, sorry. All right. Mr. Charles. Invited testimony is for 5 minutes each. Thanks. Welcome.
Got my little clock. I'm ready. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, Market-Oriented Research Center in Portland.
Thanks.
Your committee assistant is passing out my testimony, which is much longer than I'm going to actually speak. And as part of the testimony, it briefly gives sort of a snapshot of my history with this issue. Some people might think that because I work at Cascade, that of course I'm a critic of statewide land use planning, but that actually, for the first 14 years of my career in Oregon, when I ran the Oregon Environmental Council, I was a big supporter of land use planning. I only came eventually to the conclusion that the system is terminally dysfunctional because of experiences beginning in the 90s, which I lay out in my written testimony, a series of papers, books, and consulting reports in the 90s that showed a series of problems, of which the bill that you just moved was one of, you know, hundreds of examples that you can look at where a certain template for how things should work turns out in a specific case to be problematic. So from my standpoint, I, for a long time, took this as a matter of faith that it worked great, but eventually concluded that it didn't. I was interested in doing something else. I left the Environmental Council and then sort of accidentally and fortuitously wound up working at Cascade Policy Institute, where I have spent the last 12 years thinking and writing about alternative approaches. And I did follow the Big Look Task Force, and I am glad that they made the recommendations that they did in House Bill 2229. And I do have some comments on it. I think the bill itself, is, although well-intended, probably won't work. A couple reasons. First, the four overarching principles mentioned at the bottom of page 1 and 2 are not actually principles. They're hoped for outcomes, and they're so vague that they actually would not give anybody any guidance about how to live their professional lives to implement those principles. Second, the sections 6 through 10 of the bill attempt to decentralize decision-making appropriately, I think, but it's so bureaucratic and legalistic it would probably never work. Third, Section 15 mandates an urban densification policy that is so expensive as to be fiscally unsustainable. We know this because Portland's been doing it for about the last 20 years and has a fiscal crisis for virtually every form of urban infrastructure, and I think Portland is not a usable model for the rest of the state. So instead of tinkering with specific words in the bill, I'd like to suggest sort of a big conceptual alternative, which is to borrow from education policy, which is also sort of a top-down planning model, and say, you know, the charter school model for the last 10 years has been, in my view, a big success. Maybe we should create a land use version of charter schools and say that we could create an opt-out clause, basically, some sort of charter school path, or create, allow cities or counties to become charter jurisdictions under land use law and try something different that they feel is appropriate for them. You know, 10 years ago, if you were a parent and the local neighborhood school maybe worked for 90% of the people there but not for you and your kids, you were pretty much out of luck if you couldn't afford a private school. Well, you created a charter school route, and we went from zero to about 88 charter schools and growing. And that's a niche market, but it's highly successful. People involved are really happy, and it has provided an off-ramp for this political pressure that builds up when people don't fit into the template. Now, I think you could do that. You could allow counties or cities to go sort of the charter jurisdiction route and have a waiver from minimum lot size, land income restrictions, density, design, a whole series of things that may sound good when people are sitting in Portland or Salem having the big vision of the state, but in a fact-specific case similar to the one you just talked about, things come up that maybe they don't work exactly the way we would like them to work. If jurisdictions were allowed some flexibility and a requirement to monitor how those things work, and just like charter schools, have a charter that could be revoked if it doesn't work, maybe you could provide an off-ramp for people instead of them going out and hiring another lawyer or doing another ballot measure, create some way for them to get some relief from the current system. I think just in conclusion...
Thank you.
Yeah, much of what happens here in these biennial land use debates is sort of proof by assertion, and rarely do people have a chance to verify those assertions. I think if you create chances to experiment by doing something akin to charter school concepts for land use, you could allow these experiments to go forward and then have debates based on actual evidence to see what works over time, and maybe we can have multiple approaches. Thank you.
Thank you. One or two questions of Mr. Charles, if anyone's interested, and then we'll move on to our next panelist. You just have us overwhelmed.
I doubt that, but thanks.
Thank you.
Just hearing you work for the Oregon Environmental Council overwhelmed.
You didn't know that history?
I didn't.
Oh, yes.
For over 10 years.
Thank you. Mike Jordan. Mr. Jordan, how are you?
Good, thanks. Well, thank you for having me. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Mike Jordan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Metro, but please don't hold that against me. I'm here today to try to speak a bit to the bill, but also really to try and frame my comments mostly around infrastructure issues for this state, and that's probably where I have the most experience, so I'll try to limit my comments to that. I could respond to some of Mr. Charles's comments, but I won't. I've given to the assistant a letter that the Metro Council sent to the Biglet Committee as they were reviewing their draft. Those comments were to the draft of the report, not to this bill, but the Metro Council asked me to bring them down because they apply to the bill's language also in concept. So thank you for accepting that. 5 minutes on infrastructure in the state of Oregon. Okay, here we go. You are attempting to review a piece of legislation that is predominantly around the land use system. In Oregon, however, at the local level, we live with a structure that has three main streams of statutory authority which allows us to do our work. One is land use, one is governance, and one is public finance. Those three streams of statutory law are disintegrated in this state. We don't necessarily think about how local governments get to finance what they do, plan for growth for the future, and govern how they make decisions about those things. I'll give you a couple of examples from the Portland metropolitan area. It's fairly obvious that all the area within the metropolitan urban growth boundary can be considered urban. It varies, obviously, across that landscape. We currently have about 1.4 million people that live in that landscape. There are 25 cities and parts of three counties. There are about 250,000 people, roughly, of that 1.4 million that live in unincorporated Portland metropolitan area. That means they're governed by the parts of the three counties, not a city. There are many special service districts. I won't even attempt to go to that level of detail. But it presents, just that landscape of governance presents all kinds of interesting issues when you are trying to do land use planning across an urban landscape. You are trying to figure out how to finance infrastructure in that setting where there are significantly different levels of authority between those two kinds of governments. One example. County governments do not have the authority to collect franchise fees. They do not get shares of, they do not get city shares of state gas taxes. And those are significant forms of revenue that cities use to manage what is a very similar landscape to the landscape that 250,000 residents of the Portland metropolitan area live in and don't have an opportunity if their governing body so chose to get those revenues to provide infrastructure. So you have significantly different issues just from a governance perspective and how it relates to public finance when it comes to trying to supply urban level services. A sense of scope of the challenge we face, and again I'll use the metropolitan area, I might add, I'm speaking certainly from Portland's perspective, that metropolitan area, but there are six metropolitan areas in this state that have what are called metropolitan planning organizations. We have a group that gets together occasionally called OMPOC, the Oregon MPO Consortium. We are finding that the issues are very similar in all of those areas, certainly a different sense of scale, but similar kinds of issues in relating land use decisions to transportation investments particularly, but also other kinds of infrastructure investments and how to manage growth over a period of time. So while I speak from my own experience, these experiences we are finding in many parts of the state regarding urban issues. Just a rule of thumb issue. What we're facing, sense of scale. The Portland metropolitan area real market value is a little bit over $150 billion. In almost any urban landscape, large or small, the ratio of private value to public value in built is about 4 to 1 usually. So we've got roughly $35 to $40 billion worth of public investment in that landscape. That investment has been built predominantly over the last 50 years, post-World War II era, last 60 years. It was built with about
7 to 8 of every $10 coming from the federal government and the state government. That probably isn't going to be the situation going forward. We'll get some federal money and some state money, and we get that, but it's not going to be of that kind of scale. So let's look forward. In the Portland metropolitan area, we expect somewhere between 1 and 2 million more people in the next 50 years. That would say to you, as a rule of thumb, we would have to increase our investment in infrastructure generally by almost 100%, not quite, because we'll get marginal values out of some of the things we have. But also in that period, we will likely have to rebuild all the infrastructure that's been built in the last 50 years at some point during that time frame. So we and without a significant amount of federal and state money. Now, that's a big illustration, obviously, on a large landscape in this state. But I would guarantee you that that similar scenario works in the other five MPOs also, and quite frankly, in most of the cities in Oregon. Now, obviously, they're all unique. They're all different. But the sense of the enormity of this issue to local governments in this state, it is truly a big issue. You have before you a bill that you're looking at that only really has one section of it that looks directly at infrastructure. There are implications about planning for infrastructure in other parts of the bill. But Section 15 is the only section that really looks directly at infrastructure and then only talks about transportation. The citizens that the folks I work for, the elected officials of local governments in the metropolitan region, the citizens that they hear from every day in their ear, quite frankly, expect us to provide them with clean water. They expect roads that work. They expect electrical systems that work. They expect schools that work. And it's almost an expectation that has taken them off the board as things of debate. They're a level of expectation that is just not it for debate. And
Mr. Jordan, I'm going to have to ask you to
I'll wrap
conclude.
Up.
And
I can do
thanks.
That. Thank you. I'll just this last point, and then I'll close and urge you to do something. Their expectations now in an urban setting are to talk about things like parks and plazas and libraries, and certainly in many parts of this state they have been closing and not being kept up. That's where the debate lies, and we have very few tools to deal with those issues right now. I would encourage you, as you look at finance in this bill, and they are integrated pieces between land use and finance, if it's going to work, I would urge you to look at the very least, trying to give local governments as a maximum amount of flexibility to deal with their issues of integrating their investments in public investments and their land use plans to make them work. Because one without the other, quite frankly, does not work very well, and we're finding that in our environment, and we're hearing it from my colleagues across the state. I'm sorry to have gone so long.
Mr. Jordan, I appreciate your coming and giving us this perspective. I have one quick question. You mentioned the other metropolitan planning organizations. Where are they?
Salem-Keizer, Corvallis, Albany, I believe is one, Medford, Ashland, Eugene, Springfield, and Bend, Redmond, Prineville.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Jordan? Representative Esquivel.
Just wanted to concur, and what's interesting is your MPO, I was the vice chair of our MPO in Medford. What is interesting about that is that what we plan for in the MPO is completely different than the rural part of our county.
Right.
And it's like two separate little worlds, but it's very interesting, actually.
They impact each other, yeah.
But they do impact one another, and you have to get everyone in line, and I like the way we do it with the voting system we have.
Pretty stunning to me the historic perspective you gave us about reminding ourselves that the roads, highways, sewer system, water supply systems that are serving us are getting as old as some of us sitting on this panel, and they'll need maybe to have a hip replacement or two. Thank you. Anybody else before Mr. Jordan leaves? Thank you. I appreciate that overview and your specific suggestions. Now we have a panel of county planning directors, and I've got five folks on the list, and I've got only three chairs. A couple of the members of the committee had specifically asked to hear from planning directors from counties. I'd actually like to find a way, Mr. Hoyt, if we could, to have all five of them here in case there are questions that pertain to all of them. Todd Cornett with Wasco County, Kent Howe with Lane County, Doug McLean with Clackamas County, Matt Spangler with Lincoln County, and Bill Zelenka with Crook County. I'm sort of inclined to think that perhaps the question period might be the most interesting part of this. So could I ask each of you to speak for about 2 to 3 minutes for opening, and then we'll get to questions? Mr. Cornett, where are you? Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on House Bill 2229. I'll be brief and just hit a couple of the points. With regards to regional definitions of agricultural land and forest lands, Wasco County is certainly in favor of a more regional approach to the land use planning process. I think that recognizes specific regional differences amongst the counties. The criteria are very comprehensive. There are some constraints that I would point out, though, from a practical standpoint, when looking at the ability to actually effectively implement this process. One would be political differences between counties and then cities within those counties. The requirement is that it would be two or more counties. Certainly there are political differences. Some are more interested in growth, some in no growth, some in protecting agricultural resources, some allowing more economic development. So seeing those differences, I would see some potential constraints about trying to get those communities together on the same. Similar to climate differences, if you look at the example of Wasco County, we're really on the cusp between eastern and western Oregon. In the north part of our county, we have lots of cherry orchards and a burgeoning vineyard business as well. But if you get to the south and the middle and the south, you get into a lot more wheat country and also much more rangeland. So from this aspect, if you're required to go through a minimum of two counties, I'm not sure how that would work for us. So in the north, we're very much more connected with Hood River County, but in the south and the west, we're much more connected to Sherman and Jefferson County. So I'm not sure how we would pick which county to go with, and if we did pick one county versus the other, say Hood River over Jefferson or Sherman, what impact that would be to the remaining agricultural lands that didn't fit within that other one that we joined with. So I just see that as some practical difficulties trying to come up with some consistency. And then the obvious, which would be cost. There is some language in here about cost. Based on the comprehensive nature of the requirements, this would be a very, very costly process, something that counties, at least a county like Wasco, would not be able to undertake by itself. So I think that's something that needs to be looked at. You may want to consider,
if you could wrap up.
Sure. You may want to consider the opportunity to allow this to happen at an individual level, individual county level, versus a regional or a multi-county level. I think that would probably allow us to be more effective in coming up with definitions that fit our specific circumstances. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Kent Howe, director at Lane County. I was asked to address two questions, the first one being, what's it like dealing with Oregon's land use system in your county? I'll be real brief on this. The goals and guidelines have become so litigious and complex it's difficult to explain. They're very costly processes. It takes an inordinate amount of time to administer. Then once you have, there's still the appellate process following. The restrictiveness and lack of flexibility in the system led to measures 37 and 40. Need more flexibility and incentives. The lack of funding for long-range planning is problematic. Urban growth boundaries have become so sanctified that they're not a planning tool anymore for planning for growth.
the anti-annexation efforts further hamper overall effectiveness of the land use planning program. So that's how planning is in our county anyway, under the current system. Specific suggestions then to improve House Bill 2229. The we would suggest the elimination of the regional requirement if a county wants to revisit farm and forest land designations to identify other rural lands. Some counties are regions in themselves. Lane and Douglas, for example, not to mention some of the eastern Oregon counties, are very large. The county boundaries are political, but many times are also geographic. Douglas County, for example, is a single watershed basin. Lane has the entire watersheds of the Siuslaw and McKenzie and the upper Willamette. To combine with an adjacent county in order to reevaluate farm and forest land designations really doesn't make a lot of sense to us. Counties know where their land use designations are a problem. Most areas of the county are working fine in Lane County. We don't need to do another acknowledgement revisited. We don't need to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Or throw out the baby and the bathwater. Allow the counties to identify specific subregions within their county that they may want to fine-tune the farm and forest designations. When the problems are limited to a certain smaller areas of a county, to do all the farm and forest land designations is a huge, unnecessary effort that would be like acknowledgement revisited. And we do need funding for the long-range planning efforts. Regarding the regional problem-solving...
About another minute.
Okay. Regarding the regional problem solving, it wasn't successful. We had a 9-year effort in Lane County, and once a city pulled out, then that was the end of it. Really, I think regional problem solving as set up in the statutes is more for a specific problem as opposed to a general planning effort. Urban growth boundaries, there's a lot of pent-up demand in our county because the urban growth boundaries basically haven't changed in the last 30 years. And there's a great deal of interest on my board of county commissioners for rural reserves so that when the urban growth boundaries do expand, they're not going to be expanding onto the important farmlands that are adjacent. And the Big Look needs to address that. Anti-annexation efforts, again, further are hampering the way the cities are operating. So a couple of good things about the bill. I think the work group to conduct a policy-neutral review and audit of the statewide planning goals is good. The Oregon Progress Board, in cooperation with LCDC, to establish benchmarks that are going to look at economic, environmental, social, population trends that are likely to affect the state is good. Big picture. We have in this state an extremely complicated land use system. Takes a lot of time. And when I look at 2229, I don't see the streamlining or the simplification of the system. First, the operational improvement. One of the highlights of the Oregon program is Goal 1, citizen involvement. And there's the property rights versus the no-growth sentiments in this state. Implementation of the program gets incredibly bogged down and frustrating for all involved. The Big Look should have worked on putting citizen involvement in the policy planning for this state and let the implementation and administration of the program be more efficient. This would be a huge operational improvement that would simplify and streamline the process.
Thank you very much. Mr. McLean.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug McLean. I'm the planning director for Clackamas County. I've actually been a planner with Clackamas County for 30 years. So I've been at this for a while, and I go back as far as implementation of the initial goals.
Yeah.
You're going to hear somewhat of a dissenting voice from me. I think the statewide planning program has worked very well. Maybe it's a little calcified, and we need to clean it up a little bit. But while we've had our differences with the program and its administration over 30 years, I think actually in the whole it has worked very well. And I would encourage you to respect that and to understand that the statewide planning goals, in my view, have been remarkably useful. And not only that, are still a very good way to do and organize our view of planning in this state. The new term, I think, is overarching principles. That's what's set forth in this particular bill, House Bill 2229. And while I don't have a particular problem with those overarching principles, it's hard to argue with any of them. They're so broad, and there's nothing there that I can specifically argue with. I am a little nervous that they will somehow supplant the goals, which I think more accurately and better state the current our current view of what planning is all about in this state. As far as specifics with this bill, I don't like Section 6. I don't like the two-county create your own definition of farm and forest land. I think it creates some problems. It's very complicated. I doubt anyone actually would use it. But more significantly, in Clackamas County, I'd be concerned if Yamhill and Washington County decided to come up with their definition for what's important farmland, because it may affect what is a very important industry in Clackamas County. So there's a need to have that coordinated view of agriculture and forestry. I'll close by supporting the last two parts of Kent's statement. There is a need to audit the planning system, clean it up a little bit, simplify it if we can. And I want to say also that Section 15 for a county in the Portland metropolitan area is important, and a statement of how we view infrastructure financing. And I'd like to second, having been on several panels with Mike Jordan and talked about this issue, I can only say that I agree with what he has said. For years now, when I go out and try and actually do planning, it's difficult because the first question I get is, well, how do I get out of my driveway, and are you going to fix that for me? So to the extent that we can solve that question, which I don't see a lot of in House Bill 2029, we'd be better off.
Thank you. Mr. Spangler.
Thank you, Chair Nolan, members of the committee. My name is Matt Spangler. I'm the Planning and Development Director for Lincoln County of the offices in Newport. A couple of prefaces to my comments and a couple of disclaimers. First of all, I'm the guy that's like mired in all of this detail in applying the statewide planning program at the local level, so my comments are colored by sort of that view up through these stacks of administrative rules. I would echo some of what Doug had to say. I think on the rare occasions when I can sort of get up to 20,000 feet and look down, I think the statewide planning program has done a very good job of what it set out to do. But having said that, of course, when you're trying to apply things on individual fact-driven circumstances, there's some rubs. Some of that detail doesn't really fit what's out there on the ground. I think the task force made an effort to try to address probably the principal source of those rubs, which is a lot of these issues revolving around farm and forest land designations and how those lands are regulated. Unfortunately, I'm going to also echo Doug's sentiments in saying that I don't think the sections 6 through 8 of the bill really adequately resolve those questions. I think the regional approach is going to prove to be unworkable. I think if you look at our circumstance, for example, our neighboring counties are Polk, Benton, Lane, and Tillamook. We have little, if anything, in common with those counties in terms of land base, in terms of the type and extent of commercial agriculture in our area. So that's probably a non-starter for us right there. The other issue is that it does seem inordinately complicated. It looks like there are layers upon layers of process to go through to accomplish that task. And I think being mindful that in many cases in rural counties where the concept might make a lot of sense, those are also the counties with the fewest resources to actually try to do that work. I think from speaking personally from our circumstance, a more simplified approach that might address some of the issues surrounding farm and forest regulations, some fine-tuning rather than a very comprehensive redesignation approach would make more sense for us.
Thank you. Mr. Zelenka.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Bill Zelenka. I'm the planning director for Crook County. Kind of like Doug, I've been there. I've been there since 1979, and prior to that, I was also on the coast in Clatsop County. And I'm going to, I basically don't want to repeat what they've said because I'm almost in agreement with the majority of what they've said. I want to put a little different perspective in. I'd like to see the big look. I was happy to see it come out. I was happy to see some of the recommendations of getting back some of the partnership or the local cooperation. If those that were around back in 1973 when the Senate Bill 100 was passed and the goals were being adopted and the dog and pony show LBDA went around the state along with others, this was sold as a partnership. It was sold as the state establishing the goals and the counties and the cities coming up utilizing those goals with their own plans. I think if there's any, and which has occurred in a very hard manner, but I, for all the faults, I would agree that overall the system has kind of worked, but it is kind of grinding down to a halt. I think what we need to get back to is that partnership, and I don't see this in the bill. One of the things that I'm going to specifically address under is that it seems like a jurisdiction would petition the state, and then the state would come up with a definition and define it and set up all these rules. And if you look at the standards and the requirements, to me those look like siting standards or standards of land use approvals and not something that you do when you set up definitions and goals and policies. And so that's where the complexity, I think, that everybody else was mentioning, you get mired down to. To me, it makes more sense to have a county submit to the state what we define as our farm ground or our forest land. And at least in Crook County, we utilize our extension service quite a bit. We have a history of doing that. When Senate Bill 3326 was passed years ago, we used our extension office, came up with the kind of standards that defined what was generally unsuitable and what the process was, based upon our own actual experience, based upon our Farm Bureau and so forth. And so, you know, if I was offering up something, if this is going to be a partnership, let the counties identify that. We have sub-regions, as you've probably heard other people talk, within our own jurisdiction. We have two air experimental stations in Central Oregon, and they have different climates, and they're identifying, you know, different crops, and they're only about 30 miles apart. So, you know, and we've got this mixture. We're on that cusp of the high desert as well as some irrigated stuff. So, you know, if we're going to make this, you know, a partnership, let's come through, and I would agree with these guys, probably 6 through 8 we can do away with, and let's try to come up with a process that we can offer up something and have somebody react to it, because we probably on the ground definitely know much better than on a statewide basis. Generally, everybody up here has always supported the statewide planning goals. It's the cookbook. Everybody comes out with a different process when you're looking at the recipe, though.
Well, gentlemen, you have certainly made our job more interesting. Questions for the panel. Representative Esquivel, then Representative Greenlick.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, have been very troubled with 6 through 8. I'm thinking the closest we have for a sister county in Jackson is Josephine, yet we aren't alike. I'm wondering, could one of you gentlemen tell me, in your own opinion, do you think you could wade through that with another county and come out with a end product? That's where I'm coming from with it. So.
Well, no. I think we could all agree the answer to that is no.
That's what I suspicion, but I just wanted to make sure because I was looking at it. Even though we're very close to one another, yet we are strikingly different. Thank you.
If I might, though, it sounded to me like Mr. Cornett suggested that even within your own county, it's difficult to find commonality around these definitions from one part of the county to another. And yet you managed to run the county.
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct. Well, we work with the system that's in place right now, and we were able to distinguish the northern part. With some respects, we went through the go-below process, and we have a 40-acre minimum lot size for certain areas in the northern part of the county. However, even that has been starting to expand the cherries and the vineyards in certain areas where water is allowed. The remainder of the county is 160 acres. So that's been our way of dealing with that issue and reflecting the differences. But taking it to the next level, and I think taking through those complex requirements, as you said, said, I think even, you know, within our county, it would probably be difficult for us to make that process work effectively.
Okay. Thanks. Representative Greenlick?
I think it follows on what you just asked, Madam Chair. Let's say with any of your counties, you wanted to take 50,000 acres in a certain place and reclassify it from X to Y, which is, I think, what I'm thinking 5 and 6 is about asking two counties. So how would you do that? What would you do? I mean, literally, what would you do? Do you just do it by ordinance, or do you go to LCDC or to LUBA?
I think we would, if we're looking at amending it, I mean, if we were doing it in Crook County, we would get with our extension people, our soil people, our Farm Bureau, and we kind of know what grows or what doesn't grow and what has water and what doesn't have water. And at least in our country, if you don't have water, you don't have anything. And that's why I suggested that if we identify that in a very logical manner, based upon expert, based upon the history of agriculture in our community, and show what the process was to protect them and what doesn't have to be protected. You know, and that's one of the things that, you know, has always gone out the window, that is we had Goal 3 and 4. And we also had a thing called rural lands and rural development, and that just kind of got shunted off on the side, and nobody's ever really wanted to talk about it because it brings up the image of sprawl, I guess. But, you know, 50% of Crook County is federally owned. And the 75% of it is basically rangeland, and in which, you know, they talk about 160 acre sizes. Some of the rangeland, if somebody comes in for an application, if they don't, we do an analysis, and 1,000 or 2,000 acre ranch can be denied because it doesn't meet the surrounding commercial agricultural operation. And in that zone, that's our requirement, that they actually have to do a study, identify a study area, and show how, if you're splitting up ranch land, how that's going to be consistent. So we came up with that. We weren't told to do that. And that was what our own ranching community way back when came up with. That's the same kind of process that we would like to continue to do, because we do have that kind of relationship with the various agencies I've talked about.
I'm not sure. I think Section 5 and 6 is aimed at the situation where one or two counties thinks land in their county is misclassified, and this gives a way to get that land reclassified. What if you decide right now that you have land that's misclassified?
If we decide right now that we have land that's misclassified, we can attempt to change that classification using the existing rules. In Clackamas County, we have probably 80,000 acres that is classified as either agricultural or forest land. In the 25 years since our planning designations were acknowledged by the state, I can count on two hands the number of times that we've actually changed those designations. And I don't mean that to mean, and I don't state that to imply that the designations are wrong. Actually, I think it means to some extent we got the designations right. That's not also to say, and I think maybe the focus of 2229 is a little bit wrong. If there's a better way to protect farm and forest land at various areas of the county in the state, then I would support anything that would allow us to be to achieve that goal. I'm concerned about taking a step back from that goal, which in Clackamas County is very important. Agricultural economy, even in an area like ours that is urban as well as agricultural and forest-based, agriculture is a very important industry, and there are new ways of looking at the agricultural industry. We've been engaged in a process over the last 2 years where the Oregon Department of Agriculture took a new look at the agricultural economy from the standpoint more of what makes the agricultural economy work in the Portland metropolitan region, and what are the most important lands to preserve as a consequence of that. And I think that's a way of getting at the fundamental question of how you protect farm and forest land. That, to me, is a worthwhile exercise. I'm concerned, though, if we set up just a way to recognize regional differences, we're going to lose that that emphasis on protecting the agricultural and forest economies.
Okay. Let me, though, quickly, I'm going to have a little differing viewpoint. Crook County itself was the first complete jurisdiction in the state of Oregon to have its comprehensive plan with the city of Prineville and Crook County. And that was done originally in 1978. There was a big push at that time at the state level to do that because Senate Bill 100 had already been in existence for 5 years. There was questioning of all the money that was being thrown into it and everything else. And the county was encouraged to, hey, you know, throw this in there. And when Crook County first adopted our first comprehensive plan, over 92 or 93% of the county was zoned EFU, blanketed. And the discussion was, and if you look at the statutes and the rules, the administrative rules weren't in effect yet on how you do exceptions, how you do process changes. If you look at the statutes, subdivisions and other, a lot of non-farm developments were in. The minimum lot sizes were minimal because it's at the beginning, and the county would say, oh, don't worry, it's a piece of cake, you can change it. And so as time goes on and administrative rules get passed, all of a sudden then the exception rule gets passed. If you've never gone through an exception rule process hearing and approval, you know, that's the process that we have currently under the current rules, which is not necessarily the best way. You know, one of the things that we're stuck with in Eastern Oregon is that we go through, the presumption is class 1 through 6 soils is agricultural no matter what. Over here it's 1 through 4, but we get the benefit of having class 5 and 6. And if it's not irrigated, but it's still presumed to be agriculture. Doesn't matter if it's 3 inches of depth or you know, 3 feet. All our soils people have said that those soils data was never designed for land use purposes. And so what we've tried to do is we have to use them, but we've tried to come up with a review standards that is based on real agricultural practices and use and identify them. And so it's that kind of ability that I would like to see saying, hey, let us offer up what is agricultural land and we'll define it for the state and we'll defend it and give us that opportunity.
Okay. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for inviting this panel. I think we have a great deal of expertise sitting before us, and it's a good opportunity to talk to these gentlemen.
Representative Hanna gets most of the credit for suggesting
this
panel.
Thank you, Representative Hanna.
I have two questions, but I need to put a slight amount of background in. I have a 12-year history as a county commissioner, and I have sat through very painful hearings in the last several days listening to descriptions of county commissioners as being in the pockets of developers and not capable of making decisions, and I have kept my mouth shut up until this particular time, but I have some people that I respect a great deal here, and I found it very interesting to hear a lot of reference to the state as being a better decision maker than local counties. That's the first time I've heard that. Compared to the time I was living at the county level. So I'm struggling, and I'm wondering if you folks could address just a little bit the challenges that you faced over the course of time with Measure 37, Measure 49, certainly the big look attempt to look at the whole thing, but sort of never getting to completion with one before you're asked to make other changes, and how that might have been impactful in some of the county decision-making in recent times when the choice was between the proposal before you and paying the monetary assessment that would be required if you made a different decision. And then secondly, Darley, just a little bit of thought around what if we could come up with some sort of broader statewide kind of division. You're well represented here. You've got Crook and Wasco as at least getting more towards the eastern side of the state. We've got Clackamas and Lane, more the Willamette Valley sort of corridor. We have the coast And all of your soils and all of your agricultural kinds of challenges are very different. Is there a better way that we could come up with perhaps trying to find different designations in different parts of our state? They're just simple questions.
I want to let somebody else take a shot at this. Talking too much. Although I will reserve at least 30 seconds to talk about Measure 49 and 37. Maybe I'll start with that, then let somebody else talk. I don't think those are land use planning measures. They're not really part of the land use framework. They're maybe a comment on what has happened with the program and maybe a comment on the balance in the program. Clackamas County was the winner or loser, depending on your perspective, with over 1,000 claims having been filed. The decisions we made as a consequence of Measure 37 and 49, though, were not what I would characterize as land use decisions. Measures 37 and 49 are not land use measures, so it really weren't much about planning, and given the nature of Measure 37, it was a technical assessment with, since no one was going to pay the results of a favorable decision on Measure 37, simply a decision to either deny the claim or approve it based on the rules of the claim of Measure 37. It just wasn't a land use decision.
I would like to make it clear that the committee would entertain answers to this question over the next few weeks in writing, because it's a very important question. And without, I mean, it may be tough to come up with something on the spot, but if you have thoughts afterwards, I would, on behalf of the committee, welcome you to submit something in writing, because
the commissioner sat on and did that,
but I don't know if the rest of us have the capacity to come up with something like this, and we'd want to do something that's actually useful.
It is certainly not my intention to put the panel on the spot, but I think that we could learn a lot from this expertise.
Well, I think you have, as I mentioned before, you still have every jurisdiction has its own extension office. They all have their own census of ag. They've got the Department of Agriculture. You've got a lot of documentation. You have a lot of facts and figures that you can identify and map out where things are at. With GIS abilities for a lot of jurisdictions, we have greater ability to start developing a mapping of those kind of areas, and you can get a pictorial vision of where it is, and then also on the ground experience. But I think if you use, you know, I would echo, a lot of times either us locals are always viewed as the bad guy that we let anything go on and, you know, and so forth, and you need the state to watch us. But in reality, in terms of these kind of day-to-day decision-making, I think we're at the forefront and can identify it. And when these other, when I'm talking extension and everybody else, those are other state and federal agencies that we're dealing with. So that, you know, they're not in the pocket. But that's the resource to use. Just to arbitrarily use the old SCS maps, NRCS maps now, doesn't mean anything for us. But what happens on the ground and giving the agricultural history, it's factual and can be defended. And that's what I would like to see attempts at made at showing that. And if we, you know, you show concentrations and you can map it out saying, hey, you know, whether it's his nursery trees or whatever, or, you know, our mint or alfalfa, we can map those out. We can have backup from our extension guy saying, hey, this is what grows here, and this is why, and these are the areas that are protected. I think we can do the job.
If I might follow up, and then I'd certainly want those representatives to have a chance to... Part of the question for me and what confounds me about this is that 35 years ago, the people who would have been sitting in your chairs almost certainly would not have predicted that vineyards would become a billion-dollar part of our agricultural economy in this state. And I'm looking for someone who can help us make sure that we are not preventing the unforeseen billion-dollar part of our natural resources economy that is out there. And so that's what weighs on me as we think about how to look forward with the land use system in Oregon.
If I might, Hannah
and then Clem.
Respond briefly to that and partially to Representative Cowan's question as well. And I'll use our situation as an example since it is what I'm most familiar with. I think in our case, this sort of concept embodied in the bill of a wholesale redefinition or redesignation of lands, that really doesn't get at kind of the rub of our problem and probably is not something we would ever attempt to do, quite honestly. I think our land, generally speaking, is classified correctly. Our forest land, of course, that's the predominant land use in our county, and some of the most productive forest land in the world. It's generally speaking, properly designated. Our problem really is on the farmland side of things. Our land is probably correctly designated. I don't think it's necessarily correctly regulated. We probably do not provide, just to be real blunt about it, for sufficient dwelling opportunities for, and that is most of our private, non-industrially owned rural land is in our EFU zone. It's not a lot of land. It's only about 14 or 15,000 acres, but we are dead last in gross agricultural sales in the state of Oregon by county. We do not have a robustly developed agricultural economy in our county. We did at one time. We don't now. So in our case, I think what we would probably look at an option of not necessarily allowing wholesale rural land divisions out there, but some selected, albeit limited, additional dwelling opportunities. Right now, when a landowner comes to our counter and we tell them, you can't build on this land because it's high-value farmland, that's kind of an assault on common sense for most people because people simply are not, there's not a lot of large-scale commercial agriculture occurring out there. The infrastructure and the markets just simply aren't there to support that.
Okay. Representative Hannah?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing this panel to be here. I think the diversity among the panel is great, mm-hmm. geographically scattered around the state, and thank you all for coming. I want to recap a few things that I heard, and then I have a couple of questions. But, you know, and this is a compilation of comments, so I'm not picking on anybody. In fact, I'm complimenting. At least two of you mentioned that statewide planning works and or said the system works. Several of you said everything from, though it is very, very costly or costs a lot. Several of you said, consider the single county, eliminate the two-county process, don't like the two-county process, single-county system is best, and at least three of you use the word simplify or make it easier. Given the context of that, just these are my notes, just hearing you and consider that, really, you're the folks on the ground making this stuff meet the rule. You're at the counter, you're the one answering, and I loved your common sense response. A couple of questions that keep coming to me given those comments. Are you aware of any of the two counties who said during the process, can we be put together in order to do what's specifically written in the bill? Just that should be easy. That's question one. Are any of you aware of two counties who did that?
We actually met before we came here and tried to speculate on that question and could not come up with an answer, so we aren't.
So for the record, could I say that you do not know of any two counties that came together and asked for that to happen? Thank you. And my second question, among the five of you, with the years of experience you have, and the fact that you did get together, would you be able to give us, this committee, 3 to 5 reasons or elements from the bill as it's written that would make land use planning easier or more simplified?
We can start with that one. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, definitely Section 18, when it talks about the audit and the reduction of complexity, even though I didn't get a chance to mention that, I'll be number 4 that actually talks about that. This system has become very complicated over time. I think, you know, going back in time, when you said the people in our position when Senate Bill 100 was initially created, what their thoughts would the system would be, it wouldn't be as it is today. It started off, and I wouldn't say it was necessarily simple, but it was certainly less complicated. And over time, with the addition of every legislative session, new changes to the Oregon Revised Statutes with regard to farmland and different regulations and case law over time, honestly, it's very, very complex. And just looking at statute may not necessarily give you the answer, because you have to have the corresponding case law, which helps redefine what that those statutes meant. So I think going through an audit process and trying to look at the way the system works and trying to come up with simplifications, I think would go a long way. As one example, and this is something that I've struggled with for quite some time, is doing any meaningful long-range planning, particularly, I think we were probably in this table the least number of Measure 37 claims. We had 50, which probably sounds very small to some of these guys, but it ended up being a very significant impact on our office, considering that it was also at the same time as the housing boom. So we had more applications coming in. We were trying to deal with Measure 37, so we weren't getting decisions out in a timely manner. And there was just no possibility of doing long-range planning. So that's the thing that continually suffers, at least in our county. Our comprehensive plan hasn't been meaningfully updated since 1983, when it was originally acknowledged. And honestly, right now, I'm in the process of finally getting to an exclusive farm use update, and it's been 10 years. There's at least 5 legislative sessions out of date. In the meantime, we've been trying to remember what the changes have, you know, that have occurred, trying to implement those directly. It's very complicated. So as an example, one of the things that I'm interested in would be when the legislature does make a change to statute and does put things in ORS 215-283, make them either don't make them obligatory if they're really limited to one county, make them optional, that way we don't have to go through the long-range planning process, or if it is mandatory, allow us an expedited process to go through the change in our ordinances. Right now, the post-acknowledgement plan amendment process is complicated. Even if we are just doing the pass-through and not making any changes other than those that are state-mandated, what it would take us in Wasco County would be about a 110-day process. It would cost us about 75 staff hours and about $4,000. And that's simply to pass through something that was being required statutorily. Even if we didn't want to make any changes from it, as was required by statute, we're required to go through that process under the post-acknowledgement plan amendment. I'd like to see a process where, if all we're doing is trying to become consistent with statute, have some expedited way to do it. That way, we're not forced to absorb those costs. And also, when we do notify the public who then attend hearings, they get somewhat frustrated by the fact that they really have no opportunities to provide meaningful input if all we're doing is passing it through. Their meaningful input was at this level.
To just add something really quickly. We just finished an appeal hearing. It's going to go to Lubin, so I don't know what how big it's going to be. But if you look at ORS 215 and you see what the definition of a land use decision is, the definition by statute is a brief written statement explaining your decision. The decision that is getting appealed is 56 pages long. The record to my county commissioners was 2,500 pages, and after this, after going a little bit, it's probably going to be over 3,000 pages. That's not simple. That's not brief. And a lot of that is, is because of the changes not only in some of the statutes, but then changes in administrative rule, and then those get even further interpreted then by case law. And so LULA and Court of Appeals have a tendency to follow you guys. So you guys can change the law to undo some of that case law to make it simpler.
It's a good theoretic possibility. Representative Klim.
Thank you. Just two.
Oh, did you want? I'm sorry.
Well, only Chair Nolan and Representative Hannah. To answer your question, first I want to second Todd's comments. The parts of this bill that I think hold the most promise are the audit, the benchmarking portions of it that are at the end of the bill. That I think allows us to take that broader look that I referred to previously as a sort of calcification of the system, and certainly we need to do something with that. And it's other people have talked about simplification. The other part I would say that is kind of buried in here is a nod at least to the concept of transfer of development rights. And I sat on a committee with interim committee with Representative Klim, and I think that's a good idea for us to look at. There needs to be an expansion of the toolbox that we have, particularly to deal, I think, with some of the equity questions.
Representative Klim, did you?
Well, I just want to make a follow-up point, and
please,
it's very quick. Thank you. I mean, I think what it points out to is there's a ton of expertise, and I am putting you on the spot by asking the question, and it's not to belabor the point, but it's tough for me as a layperson and a legislator to look at this bill and say there's three easy things in here that make this better. And for the public, for those who are watching and don't have the bill in front of them, I do want to point out that, as Mr. Howe mentions, Section 18, I'm going to read the very beginning and the very end, Land Conservation Development Board shall appoint a work group. The very end of it is to reduce complexity. You many of you said simplify, make it more simple, make it easier. I'm glad we pick that as one of the sections that maybe helps, because I'm not sure this thing on its whole does that. But thank you.
I think that was worth it for waiting for.
Yeah, good.
Just two really, I think, basic questions for myself from our friend in the middle. You had talked about the exceptions process being essentially how someone would go about changing their designation. And we've heard a lot of testimony about something that is referred to, I thought, as non-resource designation. Are they the exact same thing, or exceptions something? No, yes,
well,
no.
Can be.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
great.
non-resource for us, and Cook County went through a non-resource process, and it wasn't really an exception, because we had to prove that the land did not meet the criteria of Goal 3. In this particular case. So we went through and identified what Goal 3 requires, and that these lands then did not meet that, and then we called it non-resource. We also can call lands that we go through an exception process non-resource also. So,
Okay, thank you. That's
they
what
are
I
distinct.
Thought. Right. You're right. Bandon Dunes was built under exception. Someone getting a soil scientist to say this is not good soil could be a non-resource application.
Right.
Excellent. Thank you. Only other one you... Oh, sorry.
You go ahead.
Yeah. The only one you had said... I forget the first part. I heard the let us defend it at the end. And is that... were you sort of arguing for a county can forward something, and then they'll deal with... When you say let us defend it, is that at LUBA, is that LCDC?
Before the commission. So if we submit a petition to define,
mm-hmm.
as this bill's written, we petition, and the commission has this parameter, and then they define it, and they go through all this stuff. What I'm saying is we can go through that, we can define it, and then we can defend it before the commission.
So you're saying you're fine with them needing to approve it, but you'll do the legwork building the case and then go to them.
Right.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Last question, and then I want to talk a little bit about next week.
And maybe it's really a comment rather than a question. As I remember back in the 2005 session, we first started talking about the big look,
there was a lot of pressure for regionalizing the land use planning system. Maybe we ought to have five regions, or maybe we ought to have something inside the valley and somewhere else. There was a lot of talk about regionalization. As I sort of vaguely followed where the Big Look was going, they couldn't figure out how to get a region, so they thought, okay, well, maybe two counties represent a region. And that was, I sort of thought, a kind of compromise to, all right, we won't have five regions, we'll have perhaps 18 regions anytime you put two counties together. And I think there isn't anybody very happy with that. But the underlying question we have is, what is the proper unit? I mean, a county is a historical accident in a lot of ways. I mean, if we go back, I'm about to defend Tualatin County next day after tomorrow as the proper seat of government for this state, and that's because there were four counties. You know, there was Clackamas and Tualatin and I think Wasco, maybe. Anyway, something like that. I don't know what they were. But we now have a system that's 36 in a state. And part of our question is, what is the right unit? Where does that happen? I don't expect you to answer it, but I think it's something. I think as we look at that two county business or regionalization or something, that's where we're going to have to answer it.
Madam Chair, sure. Representative Greenlick, I think the counties can tell you individually regions within their county that they may want to go back and adjust and look at. But I'm not sure that you'll find two counties that want to get together to identify a larger region that has common problems. That's what's going to be really difficult.
Or imagine eight counties.
Or that, yeah.
Gentlemen, this has been a very helpful discussion and exchange. I appreciate all of you taking time from your professional lives and your own counties to come and shine a little light for us. I want to reiterate my invitation. If you have specific suggestions that you make, you might suggest either directly to our committee administrator. I don't know if you want to work through the Association of Oregon Counties, but clearly the answers are not obvious, because if they were, we would be simply moving something forward. So I'd invite your guidance if you would care to offer it. Members, I am planning to have a work session on this bill next Tuesday without invited testimony. This will be a conversation among the members of the committee. So I invite you to bring your specific suggestions, something you like, you want to make sure stays in the bill, something you really think is hopeless and ought to come out, something that you think gets at an idea but not the way it's presented. And let's have a conversation. I don't intend to move the bill next week, but I'd really like for us to be able to look at each other and kind of learn from each other and see if we can't start zeroing in on the things really worth preserving and the things worth adjusting so that we can move a bill forward. I've asked Vice Chair Garrett to kind of work with the administrator to shepherd that collection of ideas and the sorting out of those ideas through, but all of us have a role in that conversation. So we will see you next Tuesday for that conversation.
Madam Chair, one question.
Yes.
Before we leave. Do you want us to have our amendments ready, or would you like us to discuss it next time and then get our amendments if we have? I mean, I think that's a very good question.
I think it is a legitimate question. Some of us might have similar ideas, and rather than have LC draft a very similar idea two or three different times, or frankly having them draft things that have only one person liking it and therefore not likely to move, out of deference to the workload that LC is under, I think it would be helpful for us to discuss ideas here first. Ultimately, obviously, any member of this committee can ask for whatever amendments they want, but we also probably all have bills that are in drafting that haven't been returned yet, so we need to be mindful of that workload for legislative counsel. So I think it would be more helpful for us to have the discussion first. Representative Cowan, you had your
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to agree with you on that concept. I really think a conversation between the committee members would be helpful before I or anyone else starts trying to pick out pieces of the bill that, well, maybe if we amended it in this manner, it might get better. I would really be interested in what the thought processes are on this panel at this point. I know I have some pretty firm thought processes, but I haven't even attempted to put them into some kind of a form that would make adjustments. I just think that conversation needs to take place. I feel really strongly about that.
That's what we will do next Tuesday afternoon. Close this work session. Adjourn the committee.